Thank you very much for inviting me here. That's the first thing I want to say. Second thing I want to say is that I feel much better since I saw the first transparency of the last speaker. That's because it was handwritten. Actually, I was quite under a bit of stress during the last 3 days, because 3 days ago I went to the physics office at the University of Connecticut and I was looking for the transparency pens, and I couldn't find any, so I asked secretary. Turns out they ran out of them 2 years ago. And they didn't bother to order any because, you know, nobody needs them anymore. So I went around knocking on the doors, and one kind soul had a set of non-permanent transparencies. So I apologize for possible blotches, you know, on the transparencies, at least since those are non-permanent ones. Okay. So I think the title that I gave to organizers is Perturbative Saturation, but I thought it was too short, so I added a little bit to it. So it reads now Perturbative Saturation, the long and the short of it. Now, that's not to say that I'm going to tell you everything there is to say about perturbative saturation. Rather, it means that I want to talk about two distinct aspects of perturbative saturation, the one relating to long-distance physics and the other one related to short-distance physics. So this is about high-energy QCD. Now, why is it interesting? Well, there's of course an experimental motivation, and it was driven first by DESI data, and of course with LHC on the horizon and Rick collecting data, that is a lot of motivation right there. But theoretically, I think most people, or many people, got interested into this problem because of the following. QCD has two facets. There's one short distance aspect of it, which is perturbative, and that's sort of high Q squared, deep inelastic scattering, jets, and so on. And then there's another one, which is non-perturbative aspects related to long-distance physics, things that happen on long time scales over large distances, like masses, form factors, and so on. Now, high-energy scattering, in a very non-trivial way, involves both of these. And so one can hope that somehow through maybe the perturbative aspects, looking at high-energy scattering, one can get some kind of a handle, or at least a little bit of a handle, on the non-perturbative physics. Now, this is a hope. So certainly we are discussing both of these aspects. How far we can get, well, we shall see. Well, let me just flash briefly a couple of explanatory transparencies for that. So why hard? What is the short distance physics? Well, and why is it plays role important role at high energies? Well, a simple picture is, of course, if you look at the hadron, the way we imagine hadron at not so large energies is something like a dilute system containing a couple of partons. Now, and those are probed by small probes like a virtual photon. Now, of course, they're not static, and there are fast quantum fluctuations around them, and those are mostly virtual gluons. Now, these fluctuations are not seen if they're too fast. So if our probe is probes longer time scales than the ones on which they fluctuate. However, at higher energy, you take and you can think about getting to higher energy by boosting this system. So then there is, of course, Lorentz time dilation, and these fluctuations freeze. Now, once they freeze, the face of the hadron becomes blacker and blacker, because you see all of these little guys, now they materialize out of this virtual state that they were in. So something like this, if you hit with a small probe, it will scatter with large probability. And you can think of this system as being characterized by a kind of intrinsic transverse momentum, which is related to the density, not one over or all, with density of these gluons. And as it becomes blacker, as energy becomes larger, then this transverse momentum becomes larger too. So one expects kind of from this naive picture that this scale, this transverse momentum scale, will dominate the final states in high multiplicity events, right? The ones that do probe probe this structure. And this scale, if it is large, then of course it is hard and therefore hopefully perturbative. Now, why soft? Well, that's a very old argument that goes back to Heisenberg. And it says that when you go to higher energy, the size of the hadron grows. And the effective size of the hadron, the effective size which is seen by an external probe. And the argument is beautifully simple. It says, well, suppose here sits our hadron. And we're in a theory where there is a finite mass gap. So that means that if we look at the density profile in this hadron, it must have exponential tails. Away from the center at the periphery, the density should decrease as e to the minus mx, where m is the mass of the lightest excitation. Now, if we probe this thing, if we hit it with some small probe, in order for there to be a scattering, an inelastic scattering event, it cannot be too far, because the energy accessible to it, which sits in the overlap between the probe and the tail of this distribution, cannot be smaller than the mass of the lightest excitation that can be produced. So we can estimate or put the limit on the total cross-section by estimating this maximal value of impact parameter at which energy in the overlap is still large enough to produce a particle. And the simple exercise here tells us, well, the energy is S divided by M. This is the exponential profile. And we find that the maximal radius, maximal impact parameter, is proportional to log S. So it grows logarithmically with energy. And so the cross-section is bounded, according to Froissart bound, by log square of energy. Now, the tails at large B, therefore, those are the ones that dominate total cross-section, and those are the ones that are determined by soft physics, the thing that sets this tail here. So at high energy, this is what we think we expect. The global aspects of the scattering, such as total cross-section, elastic cross-section, must be determined by peripheral long-distance physics. On the other hand, the multiplicities of the final states must be dominated by hard perturbative component. And the perturbative QCD saturation approach basically asks whether we can start with QCD and understand, well, one or the other, or hopefully both of these aspects, by really doing perturbation theory. Okay? So that's what I want to talk about. I want to describe to you this perturbative QCD saturation approach that starts with naive perturbation theory and then with certain resummations gets this picture of eventual blackness of the hadron. And I also want to ask, what does it tell us about this soft aspect of the total cross-section? Now, this transparency is probably redundant, but let me flash it for you anyway. This is just the kinematics, the kinematical variables that I will be using. And this is this variable X. So the way we think about perturbative scattering in QCD, the prime example is deep inelastic scattering, is in the framework of the parton model. So we think of the proton sitting here and having some partons in it. Electron comes in, emits virtual photon at virtuality Q squared, and then it hits and kicks out some partons out of the proton, and then they hadronize and generate final states X. Now, if you look at so X is the the Bjorken X is the in the picture. In the infinite momentum frame is the fraction of the longitudinal momentum of the proton, which is carried by the parton that is being kicked here. Now, if you look at the energy, W squared here is P plus Q squared. P is the momentum of the proton. Q is the momentum of the photon. So if you translate it into these variables, you see that at small values of X, X is inversely proportional to the total energy of the scattering process of the gamma star P system. So the simple way to look at it is to think about gamma star as a kind of partonometer, a probe of size 1 over Q that just counts the partons, the charged partons, I should say, in this case, that it encounters. So the elementary cross-section is just electromagnetic coupling divided by Q squared, the size of the probe, and then it's just the number of the partons that is seen at the particular value of X. Now, of course, there are perturbative corrections to this, but I will really only use the leading order notions, so I don't want to talk about the renormalization too much, but again, historic slide, so to speak. Now, the partonic densities and I depend on the resolution, of course, right? If we see with some resolution, we see three partons sitting here, increasing resolution or increasing Q squared, we can see those guys splitting into two or three. And this splitting is described by the Dirichlet equation, right? The change with resolution of partonic densities is equal to the splitting function convoluted with the partonic density at a different value of y, of the momentum fraction. Now, so it's basically this simple diagram, right? This is just the number of emitted gluons is proportional, well, I'm talking about gluons, but of course this equation itself has all the partons in it, but the number of emitted gluons is proportional to the number of the gluons or quarks that there were already in the state. So that's a linear evolution equation. Now, the fits based on Dirichlet work pretty well for deep and elastic scattering, although they have some troubling features, as we heard earlier today, like negative gluon densities. But as fits, I think they're fine. But what happens at lower x? What happens when we go to lower x? The picture changes because we are not changing resolution anymore going to lower x, but we're still producing more and more partons. And in the leading order, at least, the partons, the new partons that are generated by this Lorentz time dilation process have roughly the same size as the partons that we started from. So the picture looks like this. The face of the hadron really starts blackening. We get more of new guys sitting around the old guys, right, and producing more and more scattering. So it's gluons that I'm talking about. So this gluon cloud, this is just a picture of gluon cloud, which is pretty hot. It was fluctuating on short time scales. And then this gluon cloud cools down, and these extra gluons materialize, and the proton becomes blacker. Now, so first of all, how do we describe this process, this change in the parton distributions in perturbation theory? Well, the celebrated and time-honored by now way to do it is the BFKL evolution, which we heard about already today many times, but I don't think we saw it written, so I write here kind of a caricature of it. So this is equation, as it is written for this quantity phi, which is gluon density at fixed transverse momentum. Okay, it's related to the gluon number G, the gluon distribution function, as a derivative, logarithmic derivative with respect to momentum. So it's actually gluon density per unit momentum per unit impact parameter, so it's a dimensionless quantity. Now, the change in this gluon density is given by linear BFKL equation in the leading alpha S approximation, where K here is some kernel, and it doesn't really matter what it is for me at the moment. The thing that I want to stress here is that this equation is a linear equation, again, just like Dirichlet equation. So again, in this evolution, one assumes that the number of new gluons that are generated in this process of boost is proportional to the number of gluons that existed in the wave function previously. So there is no interaction between gluons in this evolution. But of course, when we are looking at this imaginary picture that we have in front of our minds of things getting blacker and blacker, that means that the gluons will overlap in the transfer space as energy increases. If they overlap, they should start interacting. And once they start interacting, the equation certainly should be changed. It must become a nonlinear equation. It cannot be a linear equation anymore. So it cannot, even if it is, well, there's of course no guarantee that this equation is good for anything, but it is certainly will not be good at too high energies, at too low x, because nonlinear corrections have to be taken into account. In fact, when you look at the BFKL equation itself, it kind of screams that I'm wrong, right, itself. Rather, you should look at the solution to this equation. So solution to BFKL equation, asymptotic solution, looks like this. There's a prefactor here, but it doesn't matter. And the prominent feature is this exponential in logarithm of 1 over x. And so 5k grows exponentially with this logarithm. Now the factor, the negative factor here is the diffusion factor, is taking into account the effect of diffusion. It is important, of course, because it tells you that at very large and very small momenta, this phi, the gluon density, will eventually decrease. But in a very large range of momenta, which where log of k is proportional to log of 1 over x, the dominant term is this one. Now, the value of this coupling, so this w naught is precisely the 4 log 2 alpha s over pi n, and a squared here is also of order alpha s. It doesn't matter what the number is exactly, but there we are. Now, what that means is that if we look at the cross-section, we calculate cross-section. Now, I should say, of course, this is not a cross-section of any of a real process, but we're imagining that we have a probe which probes directly gluons, which couples directly to this quantity phi. So for such a probe, the cross-section will be integral of phi over momenta, and there will be some finite integral that comes from this Gaussian in log squared, but it will always have this exponential prefactor. So we find that the cross-section at large energies grows like a power of s. And power of s is no good, because it contradicts Froissart. So certainly something is wrong. But in fact, it's worse than that. It's not really only the Froissart bound that suffers here, but the everyday notion of probability. Because we could ask, rather than about the total cross-section, we could ask what is the scattering amplitude at fixed impact parameter that is predicted by this solution. And that can be calculated, of course. And this is what it turns out to be. So here, I'm thinking of scattering some probe of radius smaller, of size smaller, on a target which has radius larger. And this particular formula, well, actually is general enough for any type of process, since I've omitted the terms that depends on this R and R. But the important thing about it again is that it has this exponential prefactor. There's some number here, which depends on the geometry, but this factor is there. So as y goes to infinity, y incidentally is log of 1 over x. It's just the rapidity here in this formula. So as y formally goes to infinity, scattering amplitude at fixed impact parameter, which is a probability, becomes greater than 1. And that, of course, is certainly unacceptable. Now, the physics of this violation is precisely the same that was emitted when we forgot about the unitarity corrections, or if you wish, about the interaction between gluons, because it's really the same problem of nonlinearity. What's happening here is that because gluon density is so large, at the same impact parameter, there are many gluons. So external probe that hits this kind of system will see all these gluons at the same impact parameter, and of course the cross-section or the scattering amplitude, probability for scattering, in this situation is not proportional anymore to the number of gluons that are seen by the probe. So clearly, one has to take into account unitarity corrections due to multiple scatterings of a probe and many gluons. Now, and this has been done. So one can derive such an equation. One can derive a nonlinear generalization of BFKL equation that takes into account these multiple scatterings. So let me try to derive it for you at least, give you a flavor of a derivation. So it's convenient to change frame and change probe a little bit. Before I was thinking about the hadron as being boosted, and now I will think about the probe as being boosted here. So all the extra energy in this evolution goes into the probe rather than into the target. And also specifically I will think about a probe as a dipole, QQ bar dipole. So imagine a QQ bar dipole that Q sitting at some transverse coordinate X and Q bar at transverse coordinate Y, and it hits a target. Now N of XY is scattering probability for this dipole. Now we boost the dipole. Well, what happens when we boost the dipole is that more gluons appear in the wave function of the dipole now. And it's easy to calculate the probability of having one extra gluon. This probability is proportional to the intensity of the field, of the Weizsäcker-Williams field of the gluons in this dipole. So in a sense, you can think of, let's say, the static quark-antiquark pair has a Coulomb field around it. Now, Coulomb field doesn't have any gluons, but once you boost it, because it's longitudinal, once you boost it, however, then part of it becomes transverse, and this transverse field can be given interpretation of actual gluons sitting in the wave function. And the number of these gluons is proportional to the intensity. So this here is nothing but the square of the dipole field, electromagnetic or gluon field of a dipole boosted to very high rapidity. It depends only on the transverse coordinates, and this log 1 over x here is what remains from its longitudinal extension, which has been integrated out here. So under the boost, then, the wave function of a dipole becomes this. So it has a component which is a dipole itself, and a component which is a dipole plus a gluon. And the coefficients are related to this probability here. Now, given this, let me make one more step here, which is simplifying a little bit the language. Rather than talking about gluon, I want to talk only about dipoles. And this can be done in the Large NC limit. So we know that a gluon is equivalent to a quark-antiquark pair as far as color indices are concerned. So this simple diagram here, quark-antiquark and a gluon, can be represented in terms of double lines as two quark-antiquark pairs. One with quark at X and antiquark at Z, and the other one with quark at Z and antiquark at Y. Okay? So using this language, I can say that one dipole under boost became a superposition of a one dipole, which sits at the original position, plus two dipoles, where dipole XZ and dipole YZ, and of course there's an integration over Z. There's some probability of getting this Z anywhere. The probability is this guy P of Z. So for this new state, the scattering probability has to take into account the fact that in this component of the Fock space, there can be events that both dipoles scatter simultaneously. So the scattering probability for this nxzyz is not just n of xz plus n of yz, but I have to subtract this probability that both dipoles scatter. So it's a simple unitarization correction, nothing more than that. Now, in principle, this P depends on many things. And in principle, what I should do is, because the change in n, which is this nxz, involves this extra P, I should also calculate how the P changes. And the change in P, so the scattering probability of two pairs, will involve the scattering probability of three pairs, and so on and so forth. So it's like a little bit like Dyson-Schwinger equations, it generates infinite system of equations with all probabilities coupled together. Now, there is a simplification which I can invoke in, so to speak, formal large NC limit. It doesn't matter why I call it formal large NC limit. You can also think about it as a type of a mean field limit, where the probability for scattering of the two is equal to the product of the probabilities. So I'm declaring that these dipoles scatter independently. So if I do that, if I write n times n, then I can write down a closed evolution equation for n, right? So what is dn by d log x, the change in the scattering probability? Well, this is what I get. I have my p of z here, probability, and then the term with a negative assigned here, which is a virtual correction, which is this minus here, plus the extra n's for the two dipoles minus the nonlinear term. So if I forget about nonlinear term for a second, this equation here is precisely BFKL equation. So it's really equation that simply neglects the multiple scattering correction, and this one is the multiple scattering correction. So what does this equation tell us? How does the multiple scattering correction term changes the properties of the solution? Right. When yesterday I was looking at my transparencies, I realized that I didn't say up to this point any names, and also didn't introduce acronyms that are in this game. So I thought, it's always my weak point. So I thought I will have a transparency for that, just so that I mention some of the names. Okay, mentioning everybody is of course too much, but I should say that the first ideas go back to Gribov, Levin, Riskin in early 80s, and then Muller and Chu did work, and then L. Muller was very active in all this business over a long time. Now, the sort of more recent incarnation of these ideas, so the equation that I just wrote down for you, which is a nonlinear equation for one of these n's, right, a closed equation, was derived by Yurikov Chegov, whereas this hierarchy that I mentioned, which you derive without assuming the independence of the scattering, this was derived by Jan Balitsky and Jim Wok. Now, I'm not going to tell you what Jim Wok is, first of all, because it's too long, and second, because, you know, the letters are being added to this acronym, you know, every year. So I figure we wait a little bit longer, it will universally cover all the alphabet, and then, you know, it doesn't matter anymore. And of course, another acronym which many of you have heard is CGC, which is something that refers to this system of dense gluons that is generated, this saturated system of dense gluons. Now, there are some differences of opinions as to what the CGC stands for, and I think the accepted version that it means color glass condensate, whereas I prefer to think about it as cold gluon clouds, so the gluons that cool down in the wave function. Anyway, I think I've done my duty here. I think I can freely use BFKL, because BFKL is kind of not an acronym even anymore. It's just a word in the English language. So, okay, so what are the properties of the solution of this nonlinear equation? I'm going back to Kovchegov's equation now. First of all, it certainly solves the problem of breakdown of the unitarity of the amplitude. Now, if you look at the right-hand side of this equation here, and if you stick n equals to 1, you see that the right-hand side vanishes. So that means that n gets closer to 1, the derivative of n vanishes. And so there is no problem of unitarity in this sense. Now, the equation has been analyzed both numerically and also analytically, and the picture that emerges is the following. So there are, well, basically two regimes of the behavior of nx minus y. There's really a third one, but that's at very, very small x minus y's, those where the diffusion didn't get to yet at a given rapidity. So for large x minus y's, this amplitude just saturates and is equal to 1. Now, when x minus y gets smaller than a certain scale, which is inverse saturation momentum, the behavior of the amplitude is quite interesting. It goes as a power of x minus y, so dimensionally it's qs squared x minus y squared, and it goes as power lambda. Now, numerically, this lambda is something like 0.64. Qs itself depends on rapidity, and very strongly so. It's an exponential of rapidity with some coefficient here which is close to BFKL exponent, not exactly, but again, doesn't matter so much. But it's a very strong growth with rapidity for QS. So two things, really. One is that the scale at which saturation happens depends exponentially on rapidity. And second, when you go below this scale, the scattering amplitude has anomalous dimension lambda. Well, perturbatively, purely perturbatively, naively perturbatively, the scattering probability would be just x minus y squared. So this lambda is the effect of this BFKL evolution, the effect of the that changes the power behavior of n. Now, if we'd rather look at it from the point of view of the intrinsic gluon distribution translated from n to phi, which can be done, the picture becomes something like this. So if I look at phi as a function of q, there are these three regions here. So below qs, phi is flat. Perturbatively, phi should go like 1 over q squared over the whole range of q's. Now, the saturation leads to flattening of it here. Now, as you go above qs, it is still flatter than perturbative 1. It goes like 1 over q squared to the power lambda, which is smaller than 1. And finally, when you get to a very large scale, which is not really relevant to anything, then it turns back into the perturbative behavior. Okay, so it goes like 1 over q squared there. Now, this property of n is what has been called, scaling, right? What was it, Henry? Geometric scaling, right? The thing is that it doesn't depend separately on y and separately on q, but only on this combination, qs divided by q. It depends on y only through this combination here. So this is, it generates for you, this kind of evolution generates for you geometric scaling. It's an entirely different question, of course, whether it is the same geometric scaling as is seen in the data, but it has this qualitative behavior. Now, I cannot resist from flashing this, because there has been a lot of attempts to apply these formulae to rig data, and they are all the ones that are based on this evolution are basically based on this form of phi of k, and essentially on the fact that this form gives you a very strong shadowing. So saturation momentum initially, at initial rapidity, you expect to be proportional to a to 1/3 for a nucleus, where a is the atomic number of the nucleus, just because it's the number of partons that is that sits at fixed at a given impact parameter, right? We're in just the longitudinal size of the nucleus. Now, with this power lambda, with this anomalous dimension lambda, phi sub a of k, so of a nucleus, becomes proportional not to a to 1/3, by a to 1/3 lambda, which is much smaller than a to 1/3. So what this suggests that there is a very strong shadowing for nuclei, and this has very drastic consequences. For example, you expect that the hadronic multiplicities will be strongly suppressed relative to the ones just scaled from PP. And in fact, there has been a pre or post diction based on this, because such a suppression is observed in Rig. And another property which also follows basically only from this behavior is that Cronin enhancement disappears with evolution and rapidity in this equation very quickly. So if you start with distribution phi of A at the onset of your evolution, which exhibits Cronin enhancement, that is, it has more gluons at low momenta than scaled proton, but less at large momenta, so that the total number is just scaled with A. After you evolve it a little bit, just one or two units in rapidity, this Cronin enhancement totally disappears, and all you see is universal suppression. So this also has been observed. What has been observed is, first of all, that in gold there is no Cronin, and then in deuterium gold there is some Cronin enhancement at mid rapidity, but as you go to higher rapidity, it disappears. It seems to disappear. Now, that corresponds indeed here. So the particles that are produced at higher rapidity there correspond to lower axes in the gold wave function. Yes?
I suspect I'm not the only person in the audience who doesn't know what Cronin.
I tried to say it in words, but basically Cronin enhancement is the effect of multiple scatterings, if you wish. If you scatter external probe even on a nucleus, right, if it undergoes several scatterings, it picks up some transverse momentum. Okay, so if you look at the spectrum of the final states of this type of process relative to the process where the same probe is scattered on protons, say, where it underwent only one scattering, you will see that transverse momenta are shifted from low values a little bit to the right. Okay, so there is a region of momenta, low momenta, where you have depletion in the final states for nucleus. But then there is a region just about, well, quote unquote QS, where you have enhancement. You have more than the naive scaling from the proton. Okay, so that's what I call Cronin here. Now, of course, you have to be more careful and not just look at the distribution, but look at the actual particle production. But on a very hand-waving level, and on the level in which these calculations are done, when you know, supposedly related to Rig, it's really all sits in this initial state wave function. Okay, so disappearance of Cronin is again this dependence, which is slower than A to 1/3. Just that. Is this?
You said that multiple scatterings suppress large energies.
No, I didn't say that multiple scattering is suppressed at large energies. No. The dependence on A is different. The multiple scatterings are certainly there, and they dominate the whole thing. This multiple scatterings is the only thing that has been taken into account here, which is nonlinear. But what happens is that you compare this expression with A to 1/3 sitting here, right, to a naively scaled one from the proton. So for proton, you would have, how do you scale it? You just take proton distribution and multiply it for this comparison by A to 1/3 up front. Okay? So, and then of course, then when you take the ratio, you find that it's much smaller than 1.
Okay?
Well, Cronin enhancement is the effect due to multiple scatterings. Okay. So the disappearance is as a function of energy. Okay? The So at not too large energy, right? If I look at it, I can take, well, I don't know how to explain it, take my initial conditions for the evolution in such a way that Cronin enhancement is there. Not just, you know, just a simple Glauber formula multiple that takes into account these multiple scatterings, right? And I see enhancement there, right? It's there. Now I evolve it with energy. And that's when it disappears. Okay, when I go to higher energy, maybe we can talk about it a little bit later, because I have 10 minutes left as of I'm not sure when. Okay, as of 5 minutes ago. Okay, thank you. Okay, so in the 5 remaining minutes, I want to talk a little bit about the soft physics that I said was of interest too. And so what does this new equation tell us about soft physics? Does it tell us anything? So to look at this, we really have to ask ourselves, what is the dependence of this N, probability scattering, on the impact parameter, which so far I haven't talked about at all. So when we are calculating sigma cross-section, we have to take N, which is a function of R, the dipole size, and impact parameter, and integrate it over impact parameter. Now, fortunately, we can understand B dependence, because even though N, probability amplitude, satisfies nonlinear equation, it turns out that if I look at this quantity, little n, which is the number of dipoles in the projectile as a function of energy, this quantity satisfies BFKL equation. So this depends on many variables, but what it is really the number of dipoles of size r at impact parameter b, which have been generated from the parent dipole of size r naught. Well, this b naught is irrelevant. Okay. Now, since n satisfies BFKL equation and the solution of BFKL equation is known, I can write it down. So this is the number of the dipoles generated from this little r naught here after evolution to y. And so what we see is, well, there's certainly a characteristic exponential here, even though it doesn't show up in the probability, it does show up in the density. And then there are correction factors. So there's this logarithm, and then there's this diffusion factor again here. Now, what this formula tells us that the projectile swells in impact parameter space. I started with little r naught, but if we look at this exponential, quite a way up to quite large b's, this expression is still exponentially enhanced. It's exponential in rapidity. So to start seeing suppression, right, dropping, start seeing that these negative terms are effective, I have to go to impact parameter where this logarithm itself is of order y. Okay, so that means that it swells quite a bit in the impact parameter. So that, of course, means that if here sits my target, and initially I was at impact parameter, which was very far away, and I missed it completely in the scattering, after the evolution, my state is so large that there is considerable overlap with the target. And what that means, it means trouble, right? So I can estimate what is the largest impact parameter at which the scattering can happen. Now, very roughly, I say the following. Suppose the target is already saturated, so it has some QS, some saturation momentum. That means that if in the overlap of the evolved wave function of the projectile and my target, I will have at least one dipole of size 1 over QS, then I will have scattering with probability 1 at this impact parameter. So my very rough estimate of the size, how far I can go to still get probability, is to take n at this size, QS minus 1, multiplied by r squared, which is the size of the target, and equate it to 1. And the answer I get is this. So it doesn't matter. Epsilon is some number. But the important thing is that b squared is exponential in rapidity, with coefficient here, which is slightly smaller than the BFKL value. It's in this particular approximation is 0.87. And numerics actually say that it's probably 0.7, closer to 0.75. But, well, it doesn't help much. So what it tells us is that the nonlinear evolution still violates the Frossar bound. Sigma goes like Bmax squared, and that's a power of s. The physics, though, mind you, of this violation of unitarity is completely different than the one in the BFKL. This effect in BFKL itself, this is a subleading effect. It's not seen in the leading expression for the cross section. But once you take into account saturation, it becomes the leading one for the scattering. Now, the physics is, of course, very, very simple. It's the same Heisenberg physics again, except that we are dealing with massless gluons. Because we have massless gluons, the tails in the distribution are actually power-like and not exponential. And exactly the same argument that gave us log squared for the cross-section in the theory with a gap gives a power behavior in the theory without a gap. So clearly this is unphysical for QCD. QCD does have a gap, so we do expect that asymptotically, certainly, this behavior will not appear. And so that means that at least these multiple scattering do not cure the maladies, the soft maladies of the approximation. Well, it does appear that one really needs confinement, not a big surprise, but just what we could have expected is confirmed. We do need confinement, and we do need mass gap to get actual unitarity of the cross section. Now, are you counting back now? Okay. Well, I have a couple of comments here. Let me just say, let me wrap up very quickly. So, we certainly have not exhausted perturbative approach. This was a very simple, well, sort of simple leading order in alpha s approximation. So if we want to take it anywhere near seriously, first of all, we have to consider higher order in alpha s corrections, which are known to be very large for BFKL. There's no reason to expect that they will be any smaller for this equation. Now, that's one type of corrections. Another one which personally I kind of prefer to think about is the so-called Pomeron loops. So those are the corrections that are due to saturation effects in the probe wave function. Right? What we did so far, we said, well, the probe is just a simple dipole, and then the emission is proportional. The emission of the extra gluon is proportional to the number of the charges that pre-existed in the wave function. Now, if the probe itself is large, has many charges in it, then, and we are emitting gluons of the momentum, which is smaller than the characteristic scale here, then these gluons will interact. So the diagrams of this type will not be suppressed. And those have to be taken into account. Now, the thing is that even though we think that we started with one with quark-anti-quark pair, as we evolve it to large density, it will have a dense wave function. And so at high enough energies, these corrections will again be important even for QQ bar. I'm supposed to stop talking. Can I sing? Okay. So never mind this one. And I don't have conclusions, so I have my last slide here. Okay. Now, this is just an interesting possibility. Now, the possibility I want to suggest here is that the perturbation theory is actually not completely dead, even if we're thinking about soft physics. Of course, it is dead asymptotically. But there may well be that there is a pre-asymptotic region where the cross-section does rise exponentially. So this is the sort of a usual Pomeron fit to soft cross sections with very small power here. So it could be, one can think of a possibility that this soft Pomeron is actually perturbative. The only way it can happen is that the effectively proton is not uniformly gray, right? If you calculate, by the way, the cross section for the PP scattering corresponds to a gray proton, but it could equally well be just small black dots. And if they are small, for a while they can grow via perturbative tails, I'm not sure. so Coulomb tails, and this can generate this kind of growth for a while. So directions need to be understood, but I think there's still some interesting questions to be asked. Thank you.
Okay, any questions for Alex?
One comment is something I said before, is that you spoke often about gluons in the proton or gluons in the projectile as if it's somehow something in the intrinsic to the wave function of the proton. Actually, it's really important to understand that in deep inelastic scattering, the simple parton model where you just scatter on a quark is not really correct, because rescattering is leading twist and has to be taken into account. In fact, that's what brings back unitarity, shadowing, and all the physics. So when it's really not this language, you're just simply saying that there's so many gluons in the proton at certain scale and so on, is not right. There's really, in fact, the physics we're seeing is, in fact, the physics of scattering of both the photon system and the proton system. It's a mutual interaction, and you can't separate them off one by one. The usual picture, the Feynman picture, is just not correct in QCD. That's the important part. I don't think that's even controversial.
Well, those are effects I've been talking about.
I'm sorry?
Yeah. Those are the effects I've been talking about, certainly.
But the language you started with, that there's gluons in the proton,
okay,
is not really right.
Let's start somewhere.
But actually, there's sort of a mystery that you posed, which is really an amazing idea. If there's less hadrons produced in heavy ion collisions, why is it that we see such incredible saturation of the wayside jet in large PT reactions at RIC? Well, if you trigger on a large PT hadron, you look at the wayside is totally disappears. It's lost. But even though you say, and maybe you're right, that there's fewer particles produced in the collision. Well, you get. Well, it's much more. We know, in fact, that it's. That people have shown, in fact, that you need an energy loss per collision, which is much more than ordinary cold reactions. Do you have an answer to that?
No.
Okay.
No, certainly not in this framework, no.
I have a question, also a comment. In some sense, when you wrote this equation and you just performed this mean field approximation, you just came up with some new parameters expression, which was a power one third times something, right? So this equation holds only for large a's.
That was the transparency that I
understood. Oh, okay. So my question is, this is a violation of Frossar bound that you told about. It seems to me that you're not allowed to talk about Frossar bound once you have this parameter in game. Either you have to go beyond the approximation when the equation was derived, or...
Well, so first of all, yes, you're right. This mean field is only valid if the scattering probability initially was large enough, right? Because the Pomeron loops, the nonlinearities in the wave function of the projectile, as you can estimate when they happen, and they happen at about these, parametrically about these values of n. And of course, if your target is also, let's say, one dipole, yes, then initially capital N is the same order as little n, where little n is the density of the projectile.
I'm saying very simple things. But if I have capital A, I have big nuclei.
Yes.
Then the cross section will grow with A.
Yes.
So if A is large, I expect it to have cross section which is large.
Yes.
So the question is it that large that it's infinity, or it's sort of you fix it large and then you look for the behavior of respect to, let's say. This equation was obtained after truncation certain number of terms.
So this
truncation automatically violates unitarity. Because if you consistently start with this equation that you impose unitarity, you automatically will come to the necessity of including Pomeron loops.
No, it is not. Okay. It depends what you mean by unitarity. It certainly doesn't violate the unitarity in the sense that the probability doesn't grow. It does unitarize it.
If I have scattering amplitude, right?
Yes.
I could verify unitarity just taking imaginary part of scattering amplitudes.
Yes.
I just substitute S bar S equal to 1. Whether it's 1 or not? I'm saying it's not 1.
No, it is 1. There's no problem with that here. It's just that the thing is that the way it reaches 1, it does unitarize amplitude, but it does so incorrectly. Okay. So Froissart bound really comes from the integration over impact parameters here, not from the amplitude at fixed impact parameter. That one is unitarized. Yes. Yes.
Perhaps we should hold other questions for the following discussion. Okay, let's thank the speaker again.